This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Good evening. Welcome to Cabinet. My name is Sina Najafi, director of Cabinet Magazine. And I am especially happy to have you here, in part because this is our first post-Sandy event. And today, this morning, we got our electricity back. So this is a fantastic moment. Yes. However, water is not back. So one complicated thing I should tell you is that the bathroom here does not work. You'll have to go through that hallway to the right, to the building's bathroom there. So we are exceptionally happy to have here this collaboration with the Cisneros Foundation and the book about Cosecha, which has just come out, and in two versions as well. I figured that I know. Oh, it is?
It was a secret.
Five more minutes. Oh, well. What did I say? Anyway.
So, yes.
So anyway, thank you very much for coming. I'm going to hand over to Graham Burnett, who's going to introduce the three panelists, including himself, and tell you about the panel. Thanks.
Thank you, Sina. So yes, I'm Graham. I'm one of the editors here at Cabinet, and it's a pleasure to have two such distinguished speakers this evening and to have the occasion to celebrate the release of this magnificent and important book. The book, and we'll hear more from Gabriel in just a moment, is the fruit of more than 22 years of conversation between Gabriel Perez Barriero and Julia Cosecha. This artist was, I think it's fair to say, something of a hero.
Life changer.
Okay, so a hero to Gabriel, who is himself a scholar of Latin American abstraction. The volume is the sixth in the conversation series, which is produced by the Cisneros Foundation. And Gabriel is, as I think many of you will know, the director of the CPPC, the Cisneros collection. He's been director there for 5 years. He's a curator, and he's going to lead us off this evening and take, I think, 15 or 20 minutes, show us some images, orient us, give us a flavor for what's in the book. And then following up is a friend and a colleague, Eva Diaz, a scholar who teaches at Pratt, just recently, and this is to be celebrated, found out she got one of the coveted Warhol writer's grants to take up a new project, a book that will be entitled The Fuller Effect, a study of contemporary artists and their specifically their critique of the project of total design. This follows on a book which is now out or about to be out next fall coming. The project about which I know a little bit more, called The Experimenters, about Black Mountain College. Eva Diaz is the person you go to if you want to talk about domes. Geodesic domes. Okay, we'll see some domes. Domes coming. Good. Without further ado, then, let me hand things over to Gabriel, who will get us started.
Great. Well, thank you. Thanks, Graham. Thanks, Sina, and everyone for being here tonight. And I have two hats tonight, and I'll get rid of the first one faster, which is as director of the CPPC. Just to tell you a little bit about the series of which this is the sixth title. This is a series called Conversations, and it's born out of the foundation's mission, which is to make better known and better understood the contributions of Latin America to global culture. And so this is done through a variety of ways, exhibitions, grants, publications, partnerships, many different ways. But this series was launched 3 years ago. This is the sixth title in the series. And what it really tries to do is fill a particular gap in our field, which is the artist's voice, the direct testimony, the oral history. And we were realizing that there were many artists. Kosice is 88 years old. Tomás Maldonado is 90 years old. We really wanted to capture sort of the lifelong testimony of these very, very important artists while they were still alive and turn that into a book. So commission the scholarship behind it and then also do the editorial production. So the six titles, we have them here. They're also all available for sale tonight. Please buy them. And as you see, there's titles with Conversations with Carlos Cruz Diaz, Tomás Maldonado, Jesús Soto, Jack Lerner, and Ferreira Goulart, which was the last book we launched. And tonight, this book by Julio Kosice. Forthcoming titles include Liliana Porter with Inés Katzenstein. That'll be launched next spring. Luis Kamnitzer and Alex Alberro, Alfredo Jar, Luis Perez Oramas, Tania Bruguera and Claire Bishop, and several others that are in the works. In February, all of these books will be, so all of the former catalog and from there on all future books will be launched, not just in paper, but also in digital format. And today, by luck and work and design, we actually have a prototype of the Kosice book. And so what I'm going to do is, instead of a PowerPoint, I'm going to essentially try out this prototype. So it may have a glitch or two in it, hopefully not. And we can, and hopefully this way, introduce the book and we can preview it together. I think Kosice is not a particularly familiar name to an American audience, and so I'm just going to kind of go through the structure of the book, which is chronological, just point out a few things, look at some of the images of his work, we can hear him speak a few times through videos, and just kind of introduce some of the ideas. And then, as I pass to my fellow panelists, our idea was very much in the spirit of Cabinet, not to do so much of an art historical specialized reading, which is usually about causes and effects, but more to think about sort of the reverberations or the suggestions that an artist like this can generate in other fields, in other adjacent fields. So to start, we'll start right at the beginning. This, I guess, was 82 years ago. This is young Mr. Kosice at the age 4. He was actually, Julio Kosice is not his real name. He was born Fernando Falk in the town of Kosice, which was then Hungary. It then changed nationality several times, and today is Slovakia. It's a border town. Now, the year this photograph was taken, he left Hungary with his two brothers. They were three orphans who crossed the Atlantic to go and live with an uncle who had set up a business as a dentist in Buenos Aires. So this was an extremely... he talks a lot about his biography. And this was an extremely important experience for him. We'll just jump to him. Hopefully this will work. And
bueno, yo primero te voy a contar qué me pasó en mi niñez, la parte retroactiva. Vos sabés que yo soy de origen húngaro, que llegué a los 4 años de edad a Buenos Aires. Me acuerdo que, porque los cumplí acá, en el trayecto de 36 días de barco, yo lo único que veía era agua y agua, agua y cielo. Ya me tenía podrido. La verdad es que me jugaba las pelotitas a bordo y todo lo demás, pero siempre veía agua yo. Y supongo que después recapacité que si el hombre, el ser humano, tiene el 75% de agua y el planetoide que vivimos también está en esa misma proporción, dije, bueno, hay una relación con lo que me interesa a mí.
So there we'll see. This was footage we filmed last year in preparing this book, and it brings up a lot of the sort of key themes in his work. One of them being the water, as he explains it there, and this relationship between the human body, between the planet, and this element of water. So that's something that's there. But there's also, I think, another thing that's significant here, which is the fact of his arriving in Buenos Aires. This is a view of Buenos Aires in the 1930s by Horacio Coppola, a very important photographer there. And I think this was also important, the fact of him being an immigrant in a strange land, fleeing a Europe in which repression was just around the corner, and finding himself in this big city, which was very alien, but also a cultural hub at the time, a place that was full of all kinds of ways to be exposed to culture in the Spanish language. His first contact was through a neighborhood librarian who was a member of the Socialist Party, who introduced him to the world of literature and ideas. And in this book, I quote, says, he encouraged me to read about Greek culture and ancient history, as well as many other things. I had quite a classic scholastic education through literature. Right about then, I came across a large volume on Leonardo da Vinci, and from then on decided to follow in the footsteps as far as a possible vocation was concerned. End of quote. In Leonardo, Kosice found a hybrid artist-scientist, working many fields at the same time, and in his own sort of characteristically ambitious way, he decided that this was the path for him. He had to be at least as important as Leonardo da Vinci. Now, at this time, as he arrived, it's interesting, his brothers set up a leather workshop. They made handbags and purses and this kind of thing, and that gave him, on the one hand, it gave him a sudden flexibility. It gave him some time on his hands to read, to go to the library. You know, he had a certain amount of independence. And it also kind of crucially gave him access to materials and to a workshop. And we'll see how important that was later. But his first, one of the things that's interesting is he really starts not so much in the visual arts. He starts as a poet. And in the early 1940s, he started writing his first poems. And it's very difficult to study him as a visual artist without considering his poetry too and his literary production in general. It's someone who's written at least 15 books and kind of constructs a parallel between the visual and the literary all the time. It's very important, be it in manifestos, be it in poetry, be it in essays, or as we'll see with interviews also. And his poems are very curious. They invent words, they create fantastic images, but at the same time he was vehemently opposed to surrealism. Which he really saw as the enemy. For Kosice, right, even at this early age, he thought that reason was paramount and that invention was a function of reason and not of irrationality. And he put it, here's another quote, "What I did not agree with was the idea that my unconscious was determining my conscious being. The majority of a person's life is conscious, even when we take references from the imagination and the unconscious." I'm going to put just a little fragment, particularly for those who
understand Spanish, sí, no termina el mundo. Poetry. Para todo esto que es eterno, como la circunstancia, esa fibra tocada, se calan y ejercitan las cosas presentes y también los objetos en gestación. Cabe en un ápice del límite configurar la abolición, la exigencia del aire, el endurecimiento del sentido, el cambio, ahora que estamos con los recursos discretos, de una inmensidad empequeñecida, sin eludir el golcese, ni siquiera poder decir su extravío.
I'll pause it there. But you'll see even the title of this poem, Golcese, it's an invented term, and the invention of language is something that becomes really central to his career and his work, the invention of language and ultimately the invention of people. And we'll see that a little bit further on. Now, by the early 1940s, he was hanging out with a group of artists and intellectuals in a cafe called the Ruy in Buenos Aires. And from the discussions, and this was very often the case, they decide that they need to publish a magazine. And so this magazine here, Arturo, was just published in a single issue in the summer of 1944. It was edited by Kosice together with three other people, Carmelo Ardenquin and Roth Rothfuss, who were two artists, and Edgar Bailey, who was a poet. The magazine is kind of all over the place. It has this, as you see, this almost abstract expressionist cover, but then inside it's all about geometric abstraction, but then it's against surrealism, but then there's kind of almost surrealist poems. So it's one of those sort of typically confusing magazines. But for Kosice, I think it really gave him the taste of what it would be to become a publicist and a propagandist, and I think this publishing this magazine was really a turning point for him, perhaps even more than for his other artists. This is the inside back cover of the magazine, where we have a phrase that was written by Kosice: "No expression, representation, signification, or meaning. Man will conquest multidimensional space." This is an important phrase in terms of what he'll develop several decades later. "Joy, the negation of all melancholy, constructive will, communion, poetry of the social contract." So just in this back cover, there's all kinds of ideas he would develop, this idea of moving out into space, but also I think this idea of joy was hugely important, and the negation of melancholy. Like, what exactly does he mean? In the book, he talks about growing up. He grew up in a working-class neighborhood, and lots of people were listening to tango, and he talks about his hatred for tango, the fact that there was always, you know, the poor mother and the man whose best friend, you know, betrayed him, and all this kind of extremely melancholic, tragic ethos around it, when what he really wanted was this joyful expression of the negation of melancholy. Now, 1 year after producing Arturo magazine, his next publication was this little booklet called Invención, which is mostly a collection of his poems. But what's important here is that this front cover, this is, as far as we know, his first visual work. It's a piece called Royi. Royi is an invented word, R-O-Y-I. And it's an articulated sculpture. As you can see, these are hinges. And so the idea is that somebody can come to it and move it around. And so this already kind of really set him aside from the other artists who were developing geometric abstraction at the time, because it's a completely interactive piece. It's a piece that creates and relies on a viewer to come and change the piece's positions each time. Let me close this. There's another view of him the following year manipulating the full-sized version of it. This work has become kind of very iconic for the development of abstraction. In that same magazine, there's another view of that same piece, Royi, where it's sort of disarticulated, and then similar works he was producing at the same time. And a lot of these were about this big, and he was producing these in the same workshop where they were making the handbags and the purses and everything else. And in spare time, he would put these together, take the photograph, and publish them. Obviously, for the art historians here, there are parallels like the Liger-Clark Bichos, which were developed in 1959, so considerably later. And we often talk about these being this kind of radical turning point of the first interactive abstract sculptures. Now, that same year he published that, he started organizing. This group was very much outside the art system. There were no galleries that would show them. There were no collectors who were interested. There were no critics writing about them. So he decided to start organizing exhibitions in private homes. This first one was in October 1945 in the home of Enrique Pichon Rivière, who was a very important psychoanalyst, another great contradiction. Here's a man who's writing volumes about how psychoanalysis is going to kill the world, and it's melancholy and it's surrealism, but this is where they hold their first exhibition. And everyone in this photograph, all of the founders of the Argentine Psychoanalytic Organization, which in the history of psychoanalysis is extremely important, they're all sitting in this room. We can identify all these people, and some of the artists too. That's Ardenkin at the back with the bushy mustache, and Kosice sitting down here. You'll see lots of pictures of him, the handsome guy with the mustache. The second exhibition was held at the home of the photographer Greta Stern, who had studied at the Bauhaus, fled Europe, and arrived in Buenos Aires, and was a very important source in terms of bringing. She brought all of the Bauhaus books, a lot of the literature about the history of European abstraction. And this was a really important moment for him, where he started to discover kind of the history of abstraction. Now, the following year, in that same exhibition at the same time, in developing this idea of the interactive sculptures, this is a detail of that photograph we saw before, where you can see a small interactive metal sculpture. And that's a work that takes even further this idea that he developed in Royi. Royi, at the end of the day, is a sculpture that sits on a table. It still has a form. But these structures here, and here's one that in fact now belongs to the Museum of Modern Art, where it was donated by Patricia Cisneros, is a work that has no base. It's a completely interactive experience. And to give you an example of that.
Estas zonas empecé a hacer más o menos en el 47, 48, no recuerdo exactamente bien, y hice una serie muy, muy pequeña, pero todos variaban. Algunas tenían dos o tres semicurvas acá, otras acá, esta tiene dos, una chiquita y un doblez, de manera que yo insisto que la obra de creación es la obra única, la irrepetible, la que no se vio antes, la obra inédita y la obra original. Por eso creo, no en este caso, sino en todos los casos, que el arte es la moneda de lo absoluto. Y yo he tratado de corregir el azar. En este caso, el azar me está corrigiendo a mí.
As you can see, he was in great shape even at age 87. You can imagine what this man was when he was 25 years old. So as we said, you know, receiving this information about the history of the European avant-garde, and it's something he mentions in that quote there. He says how important it was to be original, to be different, to not follow something that had existed elsewhere, but to develop something unique. As he puts it, quoting the book again, he says, "Reading all the manifestos and everything else gave me the feeling that I had to be categorically original, that I was, and I was. What I wanted to be was unlike anyone else, that's all." And so this idea of kind of originality for him was expressed through objects like this that really do look quite unlike anything that he might have been looking at that same period. Now, the following year in 1946, he was one of the co-founders with his two colleagues, Carmelo Ardenquín and Roth Rothfuss, of the Mahdi movement. And the Mahdi movement today is almost a kind of legendary movement. People are talking about it and considering it all the time. But it's one of those movements that's very hard to pin down what it actually was. And part of this is down to Kosice's amazing ability as a propagandist. And I don't mean that in a negative way at all. It's a key part of sort of the avant-garde strategies. And before the movement was even launched, he started to distribute flyers in the streets and in public spaces. For example, these ones, I think the most brilliant of them are these ones here, that just ask, they're about this big, and they're self-adhesive. You can lick them and stick them on places, and they put them out in public spaces. And it just says, what is Mahdi? What is the Mahdi movement? And this was before the movement existed, though. This was before the manifesto was written. This was before their first exhibition. So it's a kind of classic avant-garde provocation to put the question out there, to which there can really be no answer. Some of the other flyers were a little more elaborate, in terms of talking about Mahdi being a universal movement of art that is the aesthetic correspondence to our industrial civilization and contemporary dialectical thought. So these were out in the public sphere. I'm not sure anyone could make any sense of them. But what to me is extremely important is that these really predate the production of any work. So before there was any movement with any art or any exhibitions or any objects, there was a desire to get out in the public sphere and communicate it in this very particular way. Mahdi posited itself as a multimedia movement, so it brought together musicians, poets, visual artists, dancers. And for example, in talking about music, I'm going to play a short composition by a composer of Austrian origin who was in Buenos Aires who wrote Mahdi music to the poems of Kosice. So it was an early collaboration. This recording is from 1947, 1948. It was on an old acetate record, so it sounds terrible, but it's an amazing record of this.
Hay una variedad intervenida, desorbitado para el cuño del arte, con el mérito de alinearse en guardia, que tienden a delegar los productos al filo y la sede inicial, siguen un conducto sin pronunciación. Sobrevienen sin ninguna intención designante, desde que los alineares aparecen, contemporáneamente se describe su órbita. Su propia plataforma, a veces sumersa, cuenta ya con una fantástica libertad de triangulación que enternece hasta los extremos de la distancia más errabunda y que media entre una desafiante frención y el último presente. Pero un desprendimiento o una imprensión más.
And that gives you a sense of his, also of his poetry and of this desire to bring together different artistic forms. So in 1946, they wrote the Mahdi Manifesto, which goes through each art form. So sort of what is Mahdi painting? What is Mahdi sculpture? What is Mahdi dance? What is Mahdi architecture? But then as you see the evidence of the movement, which you can mostly see through the many magazines that they published, and here are some examples. It's one of those strange phenomena where they seem to be doing everything at the same time. There's, for example, that's one of their exhibitions. Here's an architectural plan together with a musical score. More photographs of their exhibitions were. This was the first Mahdi exhibition in 1946. So they had concerts. You can see the musicians down there at the bottom. They did poetry readings, fiction readings, so on the sort of soiree model or salon model. But when you look kind of closely, there's a dance. You could see somebody dance. Of course, you never know what these dances looked like, because that's the only evidence we have. And it's as you look at these particular manifestations very closely, you start to realize that there's very little that actually holds them together other than the great enthusiasm and organizational skill of Kosice, who is publishing them in the magazine, sending them around the world. He organized right in 1948, so very soon after the launch of this movement, He organized an exhibition in Paris, which must have been extremely hard to do. And this is one of the ways he did it. As you see, this is a page from the magazine where he's reproducing works by international artists too, Auguste Urbain, Max Bill. And so there was a constant back and forth corresponding and trying to connect and engage with an international scene of abstraction. He kept this movement going through the mid-1950s, through his magazines, and at one point it had members all over the world, in Cuba, in the United States, in pretty much anywhere you can imagine. Again, the level of adhesion to membership is really hard to determine. Sometimes there's just a letter, someone just sent an image, and he would say, well, this is a member of the Mali movement. Other times there was much more, a much closer connection between them. That was the exhibition here that they held in Paris. Now, by the mid-1950s, there's a shift in his work, and he starts to really experiment. It's also the time he starts traveling to Paris, and he starts to experiment with water, which, remember, was an important element right from his childhood, and electricity, and starts to create what he called hydrokinetic sculptures, so sculptures that were kinetic, that had movement, but that also incorporated water. I'll just show you a few seconds of... this is a later piece, but it's very typical of the works that he was doing. So you see there's a little motor that sort of bubbles the water through this. And with this kind of work, he really became pretty successful. He had exhibitions at Venice René. He kind of plugged into the international enthusiasm for kinetic art of this period. That was an example of it there. But he... Also, as he was living in Europe through that period, he embarked on a sort of really interesting project, which is to go and interview every famous person he could get his hands on. So there are he was with Tristan Tzara and Marcel Duchamp and Le Corbusier. Here we can see him with Vasarely, with Max Bill, Jesús Soto, and he interviewed them all and published those interviews. He would publish them in La Nación in Buenos Aires, and then he would also publish them in his own books. And that really sort of connected him to that whole generation of post-war European artists. Now, there's also, in talking about water, sometimes he would push this. This is the earliest piece that we have record of him using water, which is it's a very simple piece. It's called A Drop of Water Rocked at High Speed. This is from 1948, and it's just a drop of water, and it just rocks on the floor. But it's very beautiful in its simplicity. And then this was a piece he did in 1968. He had an exhibition at the Ditela Center, which was the prime avant-garde cutting-edge art center of the period. And as part of his exhibition, he did a kind of happening, I guess we would call it, which is that he made it rain on Florida Street as the main sort of commercial street in Buenos Aires, and he made it rain for 150 meters. And so on a sunny day, it would suddenly rain, and then it would stop raining. And so that was a very kind of exciting, fun piece, but also just interesting in the sense of how to bring water there. In talking about technology, just to give a sense of the way, and I think, you know, Graham and Eva know much more about sort of the implications of this, but there was always a sense that technology was always something just slightly further, that the artist's job was to imagine what was possible, and one day the scientists would catch up. So it wasn't about the feasibility of technology, but the sort of fantasy of technology. And one of the great examples, this is in the many years of visiting his studios, this was a piece I saw in about 2007. And it's what you see here, and he called this Irve, and it was... In his mind, and it's in the book, it's like, well, can you explain what this is? And he said, well, this is a machine to project volumes in three dimensions. And he says, you know, if you put a pencil here on top of this thing, it'll dematerialize, and it will rematerialize in Hong Kong or somewhere else in the world. And so when you say, well, but is it really going to do that? He said, well, it really doesn't matter. It's the wrong question to ask if that will really happen or not. What's important is to imagine that this is possible, and then one day technology will be able to do it. And I'll quote him here. He says, "This is something I work on as a kind of proposal, nothing more. I didn't do any kind of research, nor do I care to, because I'm not going to discover anything. The absolute is not given by any philosophy, technique, or need beyond the biological need, which is about moving forward towards knowledge always. We dominate neither the earth nor the elements. We don't know how to make it rain. We can't stop an earthquake. And yet there's a condition inherent to man that makes us always go a little beyond what we know." So on that note, I'll go to his one of his most important projects, which was the hydrospatial city. And this is where he really, as a continuation of all of these interests in water and science and fiction, he essentially developed a utopian environment suspended in space. And this is the project that brings together all of his interests. This is from the early 1970s. And what he did was a number of maquettes of little sculptures, but I think particularly interesting were these descriptions, so these diagrams. And this was very much his response against rationalist architecture, against an architecture where you would have bathrooms and hallways and air conditioning systems. The spaces, as he describes them, there's a space here for explosions of contained joy. Number two is a place to feel like it, para tener ganas. Four is to intensify the Milky Way with, biselados would be like, what's the word? Okay, it's gone my mind. To hydrospace the footprints of memory. So they're places that have sort of nothing to do with function. The idea is by the time we live in this environment, we're going to live in a completely aesthetic condition in which science and art will coexist and will be beyond all of the sort of day-to-day necessities that we have today. It also, as I mentioned, it also combines his interest in language and poetry. As you'll see, the descriptions of the project are as important as the actual realization of the project itself. Here's just a minute or so of what this looks like installed. But again, it's an approximation of what this experience would be like when we eventually go to live in the hydrospatial city, which is something he talks about being around the corner. It's going to happen. See, some of these maquettes even have little people in them, to kind of give you a sense of the scale. And such is his belief in the real feasibility of these projects that he even went to NASA and sat down and explained to them how this system was going to work. I love this photograph. So. I'll end here with just a kind of really with the end of the book that I think is it summarizes a lot of these interests. He's now opened a museum in his studio, and every Friday invites a whole bunch of school kids and people to come and visit and sort of experience the museum. And he talks about this experience, and I'll quote here. He says, "Even the 5-year-old preschool children that come here are amazed, and they always ask the same thing. They say, 'What is this for?' I ask him, 'Well, what do you tell them?' His answer is, 'I tell them, all of this is here to make you feel better.'" So on that note, I'll pass on to Eva. Thank you.
Terrific. So let's take a...
Sorry, just a little technical...
Are we allowed to have a second round of applause for the ebook? Was that really the debut of the ebook? I mean, it works.
It works.
It works, right?
Take it away.
Let's see if this works.
Yeah, now the PowerPoint's not going to work. It should just connect. Do you need to? Sometimes you have to press one of these to switch to display. Yeah, I don't know. No. Or maybe this thing up here. Detect. Let me try to detect display.
There you go.
Yay.
wanted to just pick up on some of the threads, particularly related to the hydrospatial. Can you guys hear me?
I don't know if that.
I think it needs to be a little
particularly
louder.
Related to the hydrospatial city, which is such a. It's both a really unique project, but so embedded in its time. I mean, it's 1972, and when Gabriel and I were talking about the book, you know, what interested me was a very characteristic tendency of visionary architects to consider their work outside of their colleagues, to think of themselves as a kind of radical inventiveness outside of technological feasibility on the one hand, but really as though their particular vision of the future will be actualized somehow by cadres of diligent engineers, but that not really considering the contradictory nature of what happens if you have several visionary architects all imagining that same fantasy of, you know, some kind of technological magic wand. And so I wanted to kind of begin with one of the main culprits, I guess you could say, of this tendency, which is Buckminster Fuller. But I wanted to actually begin with thinking about the legacy of Fuller and the kind of high point of this, some of these ideas, and really the distance we have from that now. This was a book that the founder of the Whole Earth Catalog, Stuart Brand, put together in 1977 after the wild success of the Whole Earth Catalog, which was like a hippie Bible in the late 1960s, had earned the Stuart Brand and his co-editors millions of dollars. They'd founded Portola Foundation, Point Foundation, various organizations that were dedicated to all different kinds of projects of what we would now call sustainability and other such things. When the Whole Earth Catalog folded, Stuart Brand took some of his money and self-published this book, Space Colonies, in which he solicited from various people ideas about what life off of Earth would be like. And there was a great debate within this publication that he both fostered and then was kind of interestingly, you know, published, which were people very critical of his ideas, somewhat similar to the Kosice idea that technology will catch up to us. You know, all we have to do is think the future, and we will have the future. And this technological utopianism, which at the same is kind of totally divorced from, on the one hand, a kind of functionality and instrumentality, but on the other hand, from practicality, in the sense that you can actually get these spaces produced. And so these debates were published in here, and interestingly, this was really the kind of end of this era of, I would say, the kind of whole earth, like hippie imagination of a future. And the debates that resulted from this, from the seminars and then eventually published in this publication, turned Stuart Brand much more into someone interested in personal computing, and he was very, he was funding a lot of different things in the 80s related to the kind of Silicon Valley experiments, you know, that resulted in some of the companies that are rulers and masters today, like Apple and Sun Microsystems, et cetera. So this imagination of the future, and just to give you some ideas, this is actually a guy who was hired by NASA to draw the future. This is our 1970s future. So this is actually the one on the left is based on a famous science fiction novel by Larry Niven called Ringworld, which was about an alien civilization that had invented this this kind of rotating structure that was abandoned, and this is an imagination by this illustrator of what such a world would have looked like inhabited before the novel goes through some possible catastrophe that happened to the population of the Ringworld civilization. So, you know, it's not uncommon, right, for people to imagine what it's going to look like in some space colony or some future. And to think, you know, and it's still a very radical imagination at work, though, that is thinking, this spurring, you know, that architecture, visionary architecture can do to push science, push technology into some new social reality, a new spatial reality, Notwithstanding the kind of total disconnect around the engineering, around the practicalities. And so this idea of a non-rationalist architecture, as Gabriel said, you know, really comes out of the Buckminster Fuller vision. I mean, again, Stuart Brand, the whole Earth Catalog was really dedicated in a way to Fuller worship. And they often had in the Whole Earth Catalog whole sections about how to build domes, how to think about the equitable distribution of resources, a la Fuller. And these are two projects, one very early one by Buckminster Fuller on the left, the Dymaxian Deployment Unit, which was never deployed in this format, or really any format. But this, you know, idea of someone's visionary utopia being another person's hell, right? You know, it's like the suburb, you know, the extra urban suburb essentially is what you're seeing here. And Fuller was really concerned with the housing crisis that he forecast in the post-World War II period. I mean, correctly, right? There was going to be, you know, a tremendous amount of demand for housing, and his vision of it was eventually mutated into, as he popularized the geodesic dome, mutated into a sprawl, really, of domes outside of the urban core. He feared, as many kind of cold warriors did, that the city center was extremely vulnerable and that it was necessary to really begin to evacuate it and to do that with these kinds of, often he didn't use the word prefab, but a kind of architecture that would be nomadic, portable, and that would often come as a total package, so that you would buy this, what he called the autonomous dwelling machine, and you would have it all together, and that would be your home. I mean, of course, it totally, you know, undermines any notion of, like, custom, you know, life, like, my stuff, what I like, and, you know, you would have a kind of prepackaged assembly that would come to you on the back of a truck, and that would be your life and your neighborhood. And this is a later project by Fuller from 1966 that really is a kind of exacerbation of this notion of total planning, in the sense, this Triton city. And Fuller, interestingly, very much like Kosice, was fascinated with the sea and fascinated with both buoyancy and airborne architecture, but also seafaring architecture, or different kinds of structures that would exceed the weight, the way that things on land are overbuilt. So this was, you can see here in the model, a little bit of the indication of this being a floating city. And it was commissioned for Tokyo Bay, and it was ostensibly to house up to 1 million people in this kind of high-rise sort of pyramidal structure. And when this project failed to launch there, actually the city of Baltimore in Maryland commissioned a version of it in which they were going to house low-income populations in the Chesapeake Bay. That failed, too, but apparently there's still a model of this in the mayor's office kicking around in Baltimore, so it might still happen. So this idea of a kind of architecture outside of practicality, this was not just a city on the water, it was going to be a nomadic floating city, one that you could sort of, you know, tug around to various locations, and the kind of horrible, you know, effect of that, thinking in terms of the Baltimore iteration, would be just sort of take the poor somewhere else, you know, and just tug them out of sight. And so this is also a project by Fuller from 1960, Dome Over Midtown Manhattan, with Shoji Sadao, his partner and firm at the time. You know, this was supposedly to save on snow removal costs. So. Yeah, but, you know, this obvious subtext of nuclear annihilation, some kind of who's in, who's out questions, you know, I would start to ask. And then this will be the last Fuller image I show, but this is also a project with Shoji Sadao from 1960 as well, called Cloud Nine, an indeterminate kind of spacey space, and these geodesic domes suspended. Not really clear, of course, from the image what these two moons, you know, these two new moons, artificial moons, are going to be, you know, is this habitation, is this, you know, so this kind of move between the imaging of the future and any practicality, you know, a disconnect, you know, is this a really, these are kinds of art projects and not, you know, not really viable, of course, but, you know, in this case, it is this sort of spur to think, you know, what would it be like to, you know, to have monumental architecture floating above you. There were, you know, so many different threads of Fuller influence in the 60s. Ant Farm, based initially in California, was one of them, and I just had promised Gabrielle that I was going to do some hippie porn. So, naked asses on plastic, which was really popular, you know, at the time. And there's countless versions of this in the 60s, inflatables, floating environments, and, you know, a kind of this idea of cosiches of pleasure, you know, in architecture, that you could have spaces that did not have defined, you know, program, architectural program, that would be ones of, you know, leisure as opposed to industry, and that work itself, work as technology, was a kind of perversity, and that you could reinvent the world anew around, you know, what was previously the perverse, right? Nudity, pleasure, you know, leisure. And, I mean, of course, like the dome over Midtown Manhattan, this inflatable, as you can see on the image on the left, has these valences also, though, of a kind of terror of the future, or, you know, like a fearfulness, right, of what, you know, what it might be this or it might be that. You know, it might be that we're all in gas masks, you know, in our pods, private pods, or it might be that we're, you know, in this kind of plentitude of the kind of, you know, the organic meeting, the technologically assisted in a very new way. I just wanted to show this because it's more people laying on plastic or fantasies of the kind of floating off this piece on the right, Sarsena with Airport City, so you would be able to kind of float away. And you've seen these. And to, you know, just think about, you know, just even the kind of mise-en-scene that this installation provides us of, are these, you know, individual homes? Is this, you know, cluster of, you know, of these kind of asteroidal-like structures meant to, you know, interact in some, how do you get between them? Like, all of these inventions that you, you know, as the kind of author of this space, Cosice, you know, is able to sort of keep endlessly inventing, and that's this kind of wonderful possibility of the visionary. But also, again, you know, if we tease out some of the implications of these spaces, you know, do we get more to the Dymaxian deployment unit? Like, everybody's atomized into these sites, you know, that are like pleasure centers, whatever kind of, you know, orgasmic, you know, room or whatever, you know, and it's onanistic as opposed to, you know, a kind of sense of the social, you know, a rich sense of the social. But that's the kind of interesting ambiguity of this work, is that it really, though it seems synchronically to relate to these projects I've talked about, there's these, you know, the kind of reality of how you can deal with this plexi or plastic structure. Like, what goes on? What did he, you know, as the diagrams that Gabriel showed, show us, you know, that he had particular programs, even if they were untraditional in terms of architecture. And, you know, there's more study to be done on this, these works, certainly. Another one. And here's more hippie porn to end on. I know very little about this Aleph organization, but I thought it was just a nice way to end. Why not?
Join me in thanking Eva. Okay, so it falls to me to be something like a respondent, and I think more importantly to convene a little conversation both up here and then to bring you in. And an occasion like this calls for celebration, to be sure, and we've done a little of that. We've brought that in. And so I'm torn at this point as to exactly how kind of critical it's right to be or how hard we want to engage. But maybe I'll momentarily ventriloquize a certain kind of paranoiac critic by way of picking up on a couple of the themes with which Ava concluded. She very obliquely alluded to sort of, okay, has the sort of democratic utopian vision folded on itself in these most extravagant projects. I'm going to pick up on that theme to set these two conversations not at each other, but into accord. Because I'm left wondering, and I'll put this question really to you, Gabriel, about Kosice's trajectory. Mm-hmm. We begin with these exquisitely homely, almost kind of plebeian, democratic to the point of anarchic, participatory, demotic works. And we end on what feel like, potentially at least, a set of artistic, fantasies deeply infected or at least inflected by something like the technological sublime of the Cold War. So both of these communities do the same thing. You tell a Stuart Brand story, and it's how to compost night soil in 1963 or 64 or 65, and by 78, the whole fantasy is unfolding in a set of spaces which, if you like, are command and control ecologies. No one can build these self-contained space station environments except the Pentagon and the Pentagon. And so the other space these guys are fantasizing at the same time, about which I know a little bit more, and it relates back to Kosice, is underwater environments, so the equivalent of the sort of Skylab / space world space station is the Sea Lab underwater fantasy of these self-contained environments. But you can't even sneeze in these worlds without sort of $60,000 worth of equipment to sort of evacuate the human matter from these entirely made spaces. So I guess I'll just throw that out there as a sort of shivery concern I have about the trajectory both these folk take. Though they take them, if we want to credit your character in a very kind of, I think in a serious way, Kosice's taking that trajectory, it seems to me, about 30 years earlier, if I get the timing roughly right, 25 years earlier, than the characters we associate with the same move. Does anybody, do you want to sort of tender sure. that for yeah. a moment, or is it?
It's a fascinating reading. I have to ventriloquize Kosice a little bit here. I mean, he's constantly talking about the his life work is his trajectory, and he keeps saying this. You know, it's like it's the way that the things are connected and not the things in themselves. And for him, the hydrospatial city is the ultimate democratic. So he doesn't see it through this kind of Cold War expensive lens. He sees it as something that, by that point, that won't even be an issue anymore. So I think it has a little bit less of the Cold War ethos around it, but perhaps mistakenly so. But it's not.
I think I get that. But right. Do you have any idea? And it's a pity we don't have him here. although a celebration would be in order if we did. But how could he possibly sort of? What form of the ludic lets you get there? I mean, space stations like battleships are kind of essentially, fascist environments.
Mm-hmm.
So help? I mean,
it's interesting because in the book I ask him the question of saying, well, who lives in these places and what kind of structure? Because he, as most of all of his generation, sort of flirts with the extreme left. He's much more to the center than almost all of his colleagues. I mean, his co-founder of the Mahdi movement, Ardenkin, is publishing Stalin in the magazines. I mean, this guy's a Stalinist, and Kosice never goes there. He's always a sort of democratic, you know, center-left type of figure. And it's interesting, because we say, well, do you imagine that the hydrospatial city is going to revolutionize society? And he says, well, yes, but at the end of the day, they're going to be nuclear families who live there, which I thought was a really interesting, because it's like everything else gets revolutionized, but the family unit is still the same. And that goes back to the hominess, I think, in a kind of very strange way. But there's one aspect of the maquettes that it's not really possible to appreciate here, but I've always found my eye kind of drawn to them, which is that they are, and I mean this in the nicest possible way, but they're actually kind of crappy. And what I mean by that is that there's none of that sort of fetishization of material and technology. They're really, like, all the glue is all over the place, and they're not polished properly, and the way they're cut is, and all those little figures are all kind of falling over. And so there's not, what's interesting to me is that I find that a lot of these projects tend to really give so much attention to the finish and to the machine aesthetic and the perfection. And to me, one of their, if I'm going to say a saving grace, is that they're kind of bad, you know, and that to me makes them just so much more interesting, because it's as if it doesn't really matter. It's you don't have to finish them. It's just you just have to start them. So maybe that's where a little bit, and it doesn't answer the democratic point, but it does sort of, I think, humanize it a little.
So maybe we give the same kind of question about trajectory to you for a second, and then just kind of come back to the politics. Mm-hmm. You know, Argentina across this period, complicated political history.
Yeah, yeah.
United States across the period, you're discussing also kind of very complicated mm-hmm. politics. And so maybe I thought we could bring the politics back in, and this mm-hmm. question can start that.
Yeah, I mean, that issue of master planning and who's the master, you know, is a real complicated one with these offshoots of the kind of Fuller cult. because on the one hand, you could say, yes, it's a totalitarian kind of project, you know, in which when you try to exceed the envelope of the Earth, you have technical liabilities that position you as an extremely vulnerable citizen, you know, one that is reliant on social controls that we, you know, on Earth take for granted. You know, can you go outside? You can breathe, you know, those kinds of, what you have to do to be in one of those societies. And, of course, the immense expense, this post-scarcity fantasy of the late 60s that many Fuller acolytes ascribe to, you know, that somehow, you know, things will just catch up and that we will no longer have to think about resources as scarce, you know, was a huge kind of fantasy tied into certain projects of individualism, of the whole Earth catalog. People, you know, drop off the grid, live in a geodesic dome, the land will take care of you, you know. And these neo-primitivist fantasies were just as popular as these technologically assisted ones. Mm. But on the other hand, there is something to be said for this kind of radical imagination outside of NASA or science or whatever we call, you know, our kind of chief inventors of our future, you know, is that as artists, as urban planners, as architects, you can have a stake in imagining this, and that there is some influence to the discursive field and formal effects of these works that are not just controlled by, you know, the totality, you know, the totalizing, you know, whoever it is, the Pentagon. I mean, it isn't coincidental, though, that Fuller's first successful geodesic dome assembly was in the lawn of the Pentagon, and then 2 weeks later, at Black Mountain College in a very rural experimental school in Western North Carolina. I mean, there was the very paradoxical foment around, you know, who's going to fund this stuff? Who's the audience? Who's excited about it? And it's, you know, not coincidental either that the people at Black Mountain College were more excited about the Pentagon. I mean, the uses of some of these visionary structures, at least in the Fuller trajectory, were very incidental, you know, remote Arctic landing helicopter shelters that could be airlifted in. You know, the Pentagon did buy some, but it wasn't the fantasy that Fuller had of a kind of ubiquitous sprawl or, you know, kind of proliferation of domes. But that fantasy was one that was charged by the hippie acolytes, you know, and this whole culture of the counterculture to pick up on the idea that you too can have control over this very democratic form, the dome, the pod, the inflatable, you know, permutate it, do things to it. You know, there were so many whole earth arguments about, you know, tweaks on it and you know, zomes and all these different subcategories that people were working on. And I think there was something to be said for this idea of a democracy in architecture that was not available before these kinds of projects circulated.
Yeah, so to come back to you maybe on, mm-hmm. on politics, and just to say, because you said it exactly, it seems exactly right to me, there is a kind of sequence to this in the United States. The Stuart Brand Mach 1 and that kind of neo-primitivist project is precisely about slipping the command and control tentacles of a kind of an Eisenhower-era mm-hmm. America. And part of what sort of troubles me about that trajectory in the United States through to the 1970s is that the move to sort of create microsites of resistance to that project, it seems to me, loses its momentum and is seduced again by the sort of the techno-sublime of the late Cold War. Mm-hmm. But it's such a different context in Argentina.
Yeah,
do you want to?
It's so different. I mean, it's
turn things over to the room.
Yeah, it's hard to go into sort of detail in the political situation, but I think what makes a difference is the distance at which this was from the moon landings. And I think to watch it on TV happening from a country which is very far away just makes a difference. So I think that that distance is kind of the key here. But it's interesting to me that in all his descriptions of the hydrospatial city, He it's not a sort of planetary. I mean, one of the things that it took me many years to actually figure this out is that the distance he talks about it being suspended is not out in space. It's actually in the sky. It's still within the the stratosphere. Thank you, but much higher up. And he's very particular about the fact that this city will be suspended above the Rio de la Plata, will be suspended above Buenos Aires, and he always makes that point. And that seems to me a great way of just kind of sidestepping, because of course that's the last place it's going to happen in terms of the geopolitical situation at the time. And I think that's almost a way of kind of keeping it in the terrain of the unfeasible, mm-hmm. Just through a simple geographic reference of kind of just short-circuiting that discussion. Because sure, he goes to NASA, but you know, he took the picture and then he went back home. It wasn't. We don't actually know what happened there, but it wasn't a big strategic move.
So we could almost certainly go on, but I feel like it would be great to get some folks in from the room. So at least one kind of axis for conversation that's been set up is this question of how you get from Roy and the Movil in Madera across to this utopian cosmopolis floating above the River Plate. Have we got a microphone for folks?
We
do.
If
there are people who would like to come in. Questions from the floor. We have one up here, Jeff Dalvin, in the front.
I'm just thinking about building with earth as opposed to building with water, and the occlusion of earth and the transparency of water. And there must be something in the history of utopianism that changes when you can imagine the construction of an environment that is entirely transparent, as these plastics enable. So many of the images that we saw were plexiglass and translucent domes. And so I'm wondering what you would have to say about that as in the place it took in both of these makers' work, because it seems to have something to do with politics. It also possibly has something to do with psychoanalysis, which you describe as being an origin point of aversion. So transparency, is that an important consideration?
Those were two very potent metaphors of 60s architecture. You know? So, at least for
people want you even louder in the back.
Okay, yeah. For the you know the kind of fuller fans, you know there was really a kind of belief in the spaceship Earth idea that architecture should mimic the spherical nature of the Earth, therefore being a kind of more holistic representation of how we as, you know, citizens of the world can create a new architecture outside of, you know, outside of the past. You know, it was a kind of modernist fantasy in that metaphor of the sphere and also of a transparency, as though it's a kind of political transparency too, you know, like living in a glass house, you know, you have nothing to hide, you know, and so this, you know, I think, I don't know, maybe if Gabriel can say more about the Cosice, mm-hmm. why plastic?
Yeah, I think I associate the plastic with the water, and the sort of genealogy there is you know, we saw it. So he's a kid on the boat. He sees the water. Then he makes is in his sculptures. It's the interesting kind of breaking down the idea of sculpture and introducing chance and introducing the unstable into geometry, and that when he discovers water as a sculptural material, he talks about it in those terms. The fact that it's a material which has no form. It's a material that has to be contained, and it can be moved around, and it can be rocked, and it can, and you can bubble through it. So as you're looking at those hydrokinetic pieces, they're never the same. And that's a very important idea for him, of this idea of kind of the creative continuum, but also the idea of chance. And he speaks about sort of correct, you know, the need to correct chance. And so I think for him, all of this is about a dialogue with something that is ultimately uncontrollable, be it the material, be it a life force, be it a, you know, the power of the imagination in a sort of metaphorical way. And so I think to me the plastic is just there to contain the water or to contain the energy in a way that you can still see it. So in his case, I see the plexiglass. Certainly there's a general modern fetish for plexiglass, and that's been there since the material was invented. But I think in this case, it comes charged with that additional idea that it's what allows you to see a material that wants to be everywhere at the same time.
Floor is open.
There's at least three.
I was, you know, in the presentation, I was thinking a lot about the space shuttle and this idea that we sort of live in an era where these modern fantasies have fatigued at some point, you know, that we're a generation that is now sort of seeing these things come to their final end. So is the space shuttle a relic? Is it a failure? Like, how do we conceive of that object now? It seems like with both these artists / designers, you know, with Fuller, maybe he doesn't see the end of that project in its fatigue. But with Cosice, you know, he's, how does he conceive? It seems like in his project, he understands that they will never be realized. And maybe what is his relationship, you know, now? I'd be curious to hear what you have to say.
I mean, the very specific case, I don't know. But I think there's definitely that sense of that the works that he's making are, they're not prototypes, they're tentative proposals. And again, you can see, I mean, that 3D projection machine is a great example. It's a piece of plastic with transistors and stuff glued to it. So it's not, it doesn't, but what's important about that is that I think it doesn't even try to be feasible. It's like feasibility is a trap, you know. It's much more important to make, to stimulate the imagination through the object.
Because his contempt for science fiction is total.
Yeah, and that's interesting.
He's
one of the, in the book, you know, you're asking the question, well, this sounds like science fiction. He says, no, it's absolutely not science fiction. And why not? He says, well, because this isn't fiction, this is fact. But it's not fact. It's not fact in the sense of technology. It's not that. It's not fact in the sense of prototype. It's fact at the level of creation. It's fact at the level of art. It's fact at the what he calls, you know, the currency of the absolute. So he has this idea that there is kind of an absolute that is connected to imagination and in a sense, real technology is almost an incomplete realization of that. You have to compromise so much to make a space shuttle that it just stops being interesting at a certain point. And so, you know, I think that's the way that he sort of engages and doesn't engage with real science and technology, and even to the point where, you know, the even just like the circuitry of these pieces is really bad. Like there's not a concern for how well they work. It's much more they're there as I see them as placeholders. They're as placeholders for a particular thought process and a particular type of imagination.
Which, though, I mean, that nominative, I don't know, so many visionary artist architecture, you know, this kind of zone that we're in, whatever you want to call it, you know, has this kind of authority of the artist to nominate the future, just by words alone, as though, you know, even this kind of micro argument about science fiction, it's like you start, you know, turning, you know, our reality into the artist's reality. It becomes a kind of monomaniacal project of invention, you know, where it's like, I say it's true, it is true. Mm-hmm. And it stops, you know, being a communicative one at times. But, I mean, there's something interesting in Frederick Jameson's written about this idea of science fiction as a thought experiment, not merely for the sake of, you know, a kind of imaginative flow or, you know, creative juices or whatever, but to think about alternatives to the problems of our reality, you know, and to create zones in which one can workshop those problems out, however absurdly, you know, because that is a zone outside of the kind of epistemic, if there's any way, you know, to get outside of it, to sort of try, you know, to push, you know, our little pod or whatever, like, a little further outside of the known. So, you know, whether you call it sci-fi or not, that kind of speculation, you know, is something hopefully that isn't contained within modernism, that continues today.
Yeah, no, it seems to me that right there, one has again a version of the very debate one could start around the utopian vision, in that just as science fiction has on a number of identifiable occasions functioned as a sort of locus for fantasizing emancipatory potential, it's also served, I think, again and again, in other situations you could point to, as a distraction from real political situations.
Mardi Gras, sci-fi Mardi Gras.
Yeah, you know, I think that's also in there, and that's sort of one of the things one's...
Yeah, the last image here are these slogans. It was up there for a moment in a studio, and one of them says to either Aulisad, which would be to hydrolysize politics, and ciao. And so that's kind of like, okay.
Hydrolysize politics.
Yeah, and ciao. Right. And like, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You know, I mean, that's so, I wonder so if that's a... I mean, so,
make
you know,
it go away.
Right. Political scientists in the room and some historians will probably know that one of the great arguments about the rise of civilization is a hydraulic account of the rise of civilization itself, that it was the first great civilizations to control water that were able to aggregate the resources because of irrigation. So this was, a highly controversial theory of the origin of civilization. So I wonder if he has that in mind as he suggests we should return to it. Although, again, the politics of that is absolutely centralizing. There was a hand here, I think. Yeah.
I was very struck, Gabriel, because I mean, I've read the book several times, but how you were describing the model and how playful it was and how it was like a little toy, and then Irube was a little toy. And I wonder if I mean, it's addressing, maybe he's just much more hedonistic. Maybe it's just about what you started the whole project, the whole presentation. It's Juilio. It's about, not about actually living there, it's about being in a place where you're suspended from reality and not having to deal with politics and sci-fi and all the things that bring you down. Ultimately, in the end, he says, it's about feeling good.
Yeah. Yeah, and this concept of joy, I think, is just one of the most interesting and it leitmotifs of the career, and particularly... in geometric abstraction isn't characterized usually by its joyfulness. It tends to be very serious and take itself very seriously. And most of his colleagues, like, you know, read Tomás Maldonado, who's his colleague, and it's all very, very serious. And it's about mathematics and, you know, Max Bill and all this kind of stuff.
Even kind of dour.
Dour is definitely what it is. And so this kind of idea of the joyful, I think, is one of the things that really makes him, I think, pretty unique, and it's still there even at, I mean, you see it at this age, it kind of runs all the way through. So absolutely.
Yeah, maybe one. We'll take one or two more, and then.
Thank you very much for the talk. I have one question. I wonder if we can leave aside a little bit what he says about the work. Mm-hmm. What are these objects doing in space? How are they made? What are them? And that would be one kind of question. And the other question I have is, what is the aftermath of this? I mean, what is the afterlife of his project as a whole?
What could it be?
No, what is?
I mean, I think it's almost that it's this permanent proposal. You know, like I think the fact of its unrealizability and therefore is what kind of keeps it more or less alive in many ways. And so it's hard to it's really impossible to imagine it ever really happening, and least of all the way that he's projected it. So to me it's a project and that's a little bit where it's again different from the science fiction, in that it's not a blueprint for anything. It's not that, you know, if you just give it X amount of time, you'll get there, you know, which a lot of science fiction is kind of about. Like, okay, well, once you can travel at the speed of sound, you can do this. And once you can do this, you can do this. Here, it's like, what are the steps to get from where we are to that? And you almost can't imagine what the first one is, because it's too radical. And so I think that particular place that it occupies is because even the Fuller stuff, like, it's unlikely. But you can kind of imagine, you could build a suspended, you could build a city that's on a big boat, and you could figure it out. It's probably not going to happen, but it's a blueprint in a way that I think these things are not blueprints. So that makes it hard to answer that kind of question, because I don't think we'll ever know, and that's the perhaps the poetic part of it. Yeah.
To maybe one more question.
Hi, my name is Alejandro Drón. I think I find very important this idea of the background. These cities, they don't have the same background as their orthogonal architecture. They have an undefined, unmeasurable background. So in a sense, I think what it was very important when Madrid appeared in those cities in Argentina is that it was something different from the ontology background of Europe. This idea of not having a fixed background, it's extremely important. So I agree with Pedro Barreiro that We need to see these cities as concepts, and the fact that they are not falling into a preciousism also puts to that lecture concepts which are very radical and different from what was going on in Argentina in those years. Again, surrealism, again, orthogonality, not the shaped canvas of Rotuf. And another thing that I think I find very fascinating is that the concept of happiness and consciousness, it's very related with his condition of his Jewish condition. There's something related with Hasidism and with the type of unified field through the fragmentation, and this combination of create and invent, it's a big contradiction, but he unites them, and that has something to do with certain Jewish way of living and thinking.
That's a really interesting. I should point out, Alejandro Drón is an artist who has worked with Cosice for many years, and I think it's a really intriguing reading. This sort of connection to a larger spiritual or belief system. I think it's absolutely possible that's a factor there, particularly for someone for whom personality and biography is such a part of the work. You know, there's never the sense in Cosice that these two things are parallel, that the artist doesn't matter. He's constantly saying, you know, the artist does matter, and my background and my childhood. I mean, he's constantly bringing in, feeding in biographic and very specific information. So I think that makes that reading more likely. Yeah.
That's interesting. I suppose it's good maybe as a place to bring things to a close, because we didn't end up going down on the question of joy, mm-hmm. And it's clear that that's such an important feature of the work. And the final line of the book, which you read us, mm-hmm. Where in answer to the children playing in his studio who want to know what it's for, its kind of function, Kosice gives the answer to make you feel better. And it feels to me that in that line with which you leave us in the book, a choice is to be made critically. That line is legible as a gesture at the therapeutic. Mm-hmm. But if the project is, you know, joy, I guess I have a sense of joy as being something slightly different from the kind of thin eudaimonism. And at that point, you wonder if the objects are in some sense designed to participate in a broader sort of pedagogy en route to joy. That would set these utopian things in a very different light than the story that we tell in the United States about them. That makes them really something very different. And maybe that's some of the ludic and the provocational that's in his stance as an artist, and that kind of affords a slightly different way for me to see continuity across the objects like Roy and the early works and these later things. They could all be speaking to that. Maybe a last
Yeah, just a last one. I think there it's interesting to compare, to bring Lisha Clark back into the conversation, where she really does develop a therapeutic and somewhat pedagogical practice. And I think this is so different from that, because first, I think it doesn't take itself as seriously, which is important. I think it's a more superficial project in the best sense of the word. You know, it doesn't rely on a psychoanalytic body of knowledge to work. I think it's much more sculptural in a very basic way in many ways. But that, I think, is a key to its success. And I think as we were talking about with science, I think the relationship to joy is something similar. It's almost, this was made as a proposition of a joyful existence. Go do with it what you want. You know, I don't think there's a system associated with it. I think it's much looser, much more instinctive, and in a way, it's more seductive for that reason, perhaps.
Go do with it what you want. Join me in thanking. Yeah.